Chairman, members of the committee, I'm grateful for this opportunity to share with you my views on President-elect Carter's decision to nominate me for the post of Director of Central Intelligence, and to answer the scurrilous and unfounded personal attacks which have been circulated against me, largely on an anonymous basis. I did not seek or lightly accept this assignment, and some of my friends have suggested that anyone agreeing to take this job lacks either the sanity or the judgment necessary to fulfill it. I recognize that the successes of the intelligence community are largely unspoken, while its errors are roundly assailed. That it is often accused of deeds that it never committed or that it undertook at the request of higher authority. And that the agency and its employees are rarely able to defend themselves publicly against these attacks. In recent days, I've had the same experience. But I do not intend to be intimidated by those who wish to strike at me or my policies or through me at Governor Carter by personal attacks on my integrity and probity, grossly distorting the facts and maliciously twisting my words. I prize both my country and my honor too greatly to desert this post under that kind of cloud. And despite the prejudgments already voiced by some members of the committee before I have been heard, I am here to appeal to the sense of fairness of the members of this committee. I recognize that some of you have legitimate questions concerning my qualifications. But before dealing with those questions, I must, as a matter of personal privilege, respond to the personal attacks upon my character, which my nomination has suddenly stirred. First, it has been said that I leaked or otherwise conveyed classified information for political or personal purposes, or took it upon myself to declassify documents, or ignore or evade the law. That charge is totally false. In the White House, I drew upon classified materials in backgrounding the press only when I was specifically directed to do so by the president, who clearly had such authority. And I took documents home for review only in those rare instances when I would otherwise have spent 24 hours a day in that office. Judging from the opening comments of some members of this committee, they have never leaked secret information to the press, and I commend them for that unique standing. But speaking for myself, I have never compromised the national security of this country or approved of anyone else doing so. My affidavits in the lawsuits brought against the New York Times and Daniel Ellsberg regarding publication of the Pentagon Papers accurately described the practices then prevalent in Washington, not as I thought they should have been, but as they were.
It will be placed in the record.
I wonder if it could be done now so there'd be no question about the text of them under Mr. Sorensen's testimony. He has referred to them. That's the reason I raised it now.
Can't you wait until he's finished?
We can, but he's referred to papers that aren't in the record, and that's the reason I thought it might be. He might want to put them in himself.
I'd be very glad to do that, Mr. Chairman, and I would ask that the affidavit filed in the case against the New York Times be submitted, as well as the affidavit submitted in the case against Daniel Ellsberg. For some strange reason, all of the anonymous attacks have referred only to the Ellsberg comment affidavit and not to the New York Times affidavit.
Mr. Sorensen, I will, in compliance with the request made, I will show you an affidavit
In the case of United States of America versus Anthony Joseph Russo Jr., Daniel Ellsberg, defendants, State of New York, County of New York, and dated... dated the 30th day of June, 1972. Mr. Sorensen, this is a typed copy of the original. May I show this to you, sir?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I also have another affidavit in the case of United States of America versus New York Times Company. And this is dated June the 17th, 1971. I show you this also. The affidavit in the case of United States of America versus Russo and Ellsberg, is that an affidavit which was submitted by you, sir?
I'm assuming it is a copy of the original, yes, sir.
And in the case of United States versus New York Times, is that also an affidavit which was submitted by you in this case?
I'm assuming it is a copy of the original, yes, sir.
Without objection, the Ellsberg affidavit will be placed in the record as Exhibit A and the New York Times affidavit as Exhibit B. Please proceed, sir.
I'll repeat my last sentence. My affidavits in the lawsuits brought against the New York Times and Daniel Ellsberg regarding publication of the Pentagon Papers accurately described the practices then prevalent in Washington, not as I thought they should have been, but as they were. Almost identical affidavits were submitted by a former Assistant Secretary of State, a former State Department legal advisor, and a former ambassador. During my White House service, I received the highest security clearances from the CIA, and I received them again in the last few weeks. Indeed, I have something of a reputation for guarding secrets, whether they be those of my government, my clients, or my friends. No one has ever charged me with conveying classified information to others or mislaying classified materials. Second, it has been said that I improperly took classified documents with me from the White House when I left government service, improperly used them in writing my book on President Kennedy, and improperly obtained a tax deduction for donating them to the John F. Kennedy Library. Those charges are totally false. Upon the announcement in early 1964 that I was leaving the White House, I was visited by the Assistant Archivist of the United States, an official in the General Services Administration. He informed me that the papers in my files that I had created and accumulated during the period of my service in the White House were regarded by both law and historical precedent as my personal property, and further that I was entitled to make any use of those papers that I deemed appropriate, whether selling them, as some former White House aides had done, writing books based on them, as other former aides had done, or donating them to an appropriate educational institution with a tax deduction on the value of the gift, as still others had done. This was the law conveyed to me by the Archivist of the United States. Upon my signing on February 14, 1964, a letter of intent to donate my papers to the Kennedy Library, the Archivist's office sorted and packed my files, presumably leaving behind anything that was not mine, and transferred them to a GSA depository in the Boston area. The GSA then sent to my home in Massachusetts certain of those papers which I had selected as necessary background materials for my book. The GSA collected them from me upon completion of my manuscript, and the entire lot of my papers was then transmitted to the John F. Kennedy Library, to which I donated them. Naturally, there were classified papers among them, although no communications intelligence reports. Just as there were classified documents among the papers taken upon their departure from the White House by the principals of every president, at least since Woodrow Wilson, including Colonel House, Samuel Rosenman, Harry Hopkins, Sherman Adams, McGeorge Bundy, and many, many others. Like most of those named, I reviewed my papers, including classified papers, in preparing a book on my experiences. Just as Gerald Ford, at his confirmation hearing, acknowledged drawing upon top secret documents in his possession when writing his book on the Warren Commission. In the decade since my book was published, no one has suggested that security was in any way breached by anything in my book, and it was, in fact, submitted for clearance in advance to the National Security Advisor to the President, to his former deputy, and to the former Deputy Secretary of Defense. My handling of classified information was at all times in accordance with the then existing laws, regulations, and practices. Upon donating my papers to the Kennedy Library, instead of selling them individually for a far larger amount, I received the tax deduction to which I was entitled by law, just as many former government officials did over the years, including, in addition to those, some or all of those already mentioned, former Ambassador Galbraith, former White House aide Arthur Schlesinger, and former Governor and Ambassador Adlai Stevenson. No doubt arguments can be made against the practice begun by George Washington of White House occupants taking their papers with them. John Eisenhower has recently stated, for example, that his father inherited from Truman and left to Kennedy no papers other than the instructions on nuclear attack procedures. That at the time I took my papers in 1964, that was clearly the accepted view of the law. No doubt arguments can be made against permitting deductions on the donation of papers by former government officials, and such arguments were made when the law was changed in 1969. But that was nevertheless the law prior to that time. All of the above actions were taken with the full knowledge and approval of the United States government and were publicly described in the well-publicized affidavits which I filed in the New York Times case and subsequently in the Ellsberg case. Those two cases involved important First Amendment issues, including the public's right to know the tragic history of the Vietnam War. Whatever improvements might have been made in the wording of my affidavits, I make no apology for having responded to the requests of counsel in both cases to attest to the inconsistencies and anomalies of government classification practices. Third, it has been said that I avoided military service as a pacifist during World War II and the Korean War. This charge is totally false. I have never sought to avoid military service, hazardous or otherwise, in wartime or any other time. I have never advocated for the United States a policy of pacifism, non-resistance to attack, or unilateral disarmament. The facts are that I registered for the draft upon becoming 18 years of age in 1946, a year after World War II ended. And shortly thereafter expressed the philosophy of nonviolence with which I had been reared by two deeply idealistic parents by requesting not an avoidance of military duty or hazardous duty, but military service in a non-combatant capacity, classification 1AO, referring by way of illustration to serve on the battlefield as a medical corpsman saving lives instead of taking lives. This status was granted. My action was largely symbolic, inasmuch as our country was not then at war or expected to go to war. I have never, in my service on the Executive Committee of the National Security Council during the Cuban Missile Crisis or at any other time, permitted my preference for personal nonviolence to inhibit in any way my advice to the President on the military and other options available as a matter of national policy. I would not have accepted Governor Carter's designation to be Director of Central Intelligence were I not prepared to carry out every lawful order of the President conceivably connected with this post. Fourth, it has been said that my legal representation of multinational corporations and foreign governments poses a conflict of interest in undertaking this assignment. This charge is patently absurd. Over the years, the highest national security officials in our country have frequently represented such clients before taking office, including Messrs. Dulles, Acheson, Rogers, McCloy, Stevenson, and a host of others. But no one challenged their right to serve or later claimed that their actions were prejudiced because of those earlier ties. My only representations of foreign governments were the brief occasions on which I represented the governments of Iran, Zaire, Sierra Leone, and Newfoundland in commercial disputes or negotiations. In no country did I have any connection with or firsthand knowledge of any activities of either their intelligence agencies or our own. Nor do I have now any obligations or prejudices regarding any foreign country which would interfere with any official duties. The fifth and final charge is the suggestion that I must have been somehow involved in the Kennedy White House plots to assassinate foreign leaders. That charge is totally false. I have previously testified under oath, and I do so again today, that I knew nothing of such plots. And no one who did has ever stated or ever could state, nor did your predecessor committee find or suggest that I was informed or involved in any way. The record is equally clear that I had no advance knowledge or involvement of any kind in the Bay of Pigs or in any CIA covert operations. Mr. Chairman, far more than any job or title, I value my good name. I deeply resent this reckless scattering of baseless personal accusations in order to suppress a different point of view. I respectfully ask this committee, whatever the fate of my nomination, to consider the evidence submitted today and previously submitted to your staff director, and to make it clear that these personal charges are wholly false and without foundation and not the basis for the committee's view of my nomination. With these personal charges out of the way, we can turn now to the question of my qualifications, to legitimate questions raised by those with whom I respectfully disagree, but who are entitled to raise what they regard as valid questions. There are basically two such questions. First is the question of my experience in intelligence. I was an observer at National Security Council meetings and a reader of intelligence reports in the White House. And I worked closely with the CIA and other national security officials during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I have, since leaving the White House, written and lectured widely on international affairs and engaged in negotiations with dozens, if not hundreds, of top foreign officials. I was requested by the Ford White House a year ago to provide advice and consultation on its reorganization of the intelligence effort. My qualifications for this post have been endorsed by John McCone, Clark Clifford, Averill Harriman, Admiral Elmo Zumwalt, General James Gavin, and others who know of my work. Most importantly, I was chosen by the President-elect as someone sufficiently in his personal trust and confidence to bring him the hard, unvarnished, unpleasant facts and to reject any improper orders, whatever their source. As someone who possessed the integrity necessary to continue the task of restoring public trust and confidence in the CIA, and earning that trust and confidence by keeping the agency accountable and free of abuse. And as someone with a degree of intellect and independence required to protect the integrity of the intelligence process from outside pressures in politics. But I recognize that there are those inside and outside of the intelligence establishment who disagree with the Murphy Commission recommendation that an outsider always be named to this post, who refuse to recognize the totally nonpartisan leadership provided by George Bush as DCI despite earlier concerns about his partisan background, or who see no value for this post in a lawyer's sensitivities to civil liberties and lawful conduct. These people believe that only someone from inside the military or intelligence establishment has the experience necessary for this job. I disagree. Second is the question of my views. Although, as previously indicated, I am not a pacifist, I do favor a foreign policy that prefers, where possible, the risks of peace to the risks of war. Although, as previously indicated, I fully recognize the need for legitimate government secrecy, which is in fact weakened by overclassification, I do believe in the right of the Congress and public to receive far more information than they presently do from all government agencies, including the CIA. I believe as well in the application of moral and legal standards to national security decisions, including the limitation of covert operations to extraordinary circumstances involving the vital national interests of our country, with timely review by the appropriate congressional committees and written authorization by the President and his senior cabinet officials. There are those who disagree with these views and who regard them as incompatible with the duties of a Director of Central Intelligence, paying little heed, apparently, to the fact that the director's real responsibility is to provide leadership to the intelligence community and objective intelligence, not policy, to the president and his policymakers. These critics prefer to view this post as part of the national security decision-making apparatus, and prefer in that post, understandably, someone with policy commitments more like their own. Obviously, I disagree with that view as well. But it is now clear, Mr. Chairman, that a substantial portion of the United States Senate and many members of the intelligence community are not yet ready to accept as Director of Central Intelligence an outsider who believes, as I believe, on these two legitimate questions. It is equally clear that to continue fighting for this post, which would be my natural inclination, would only handicap the new administration if I am rejected, or handicap my effectiveness as director if I am confirmed. It is, therefore, with deep regret that I am asking Governor Carter to withdraw my designation as Director of Central Intelligence. My regret stems not from my failure to get this post, but from my concern for the future of our country. I return to private life with a clear conscience. When my nomination was announced on Christmas Eve, my youngest son said to me, "Now you will have to do some things you don't want to do." And I replied, "I never will." I have never compromised my conscience, and I am unwilling to do so now in order to assure my nomination. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for hearing me out and for the courtesies you have extended to me over the past few weeks. I will be glad to answer any questions you think necessary and to answer those of the press immediately after the conclusion of this hearing.
Mr. Sorensen, needless to say, this was not expected. The committee was prepared to proceed. I know that this has been a difficult time for you, and may I say that it has been a difficult time for the members of my committee. But knowing Theodore Sorensen, I'm certain that this painful episode will not in any way dampen his interest and concern in the well-being of this country, because I'm certain your love for your country will continue. We're all aware of your great service to this country since 1951, and I think it would be a great loss to us if you decided not to continue this tradition of service. I'm certain you will not fail us. If it is of any consolation to you, sir, this committee has received a report from an agency of the intelligence community, incidentally one of the toughest agencies, one that is required to clear all nominees, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has given you a 4-star rating. Consider you loyal, patriotic, and should be considered for any classified position. I'm sorry that I cannot make that report part of the record because it is not a type of report that can be made part of the record. But I can tell you, as chairman of this committee, having seen the report, and I welcome all the members of my committee to look at it, you have been given a 4-star rating. And Mr. Sorensen, I hope that you will now leave this room with, you will not leave this room with bitterness, although there is justification for that. I hope you will leave this room knowing that we have tried to do our best as members of the United States Senate and as members of this committee. I thank you for having considered this nomination. And as chairman of this committee, I await the pleasure of the President of the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to say that I had the opportunity this week to visit with Mr. Sorensen at quite great length on two different occasions. And I'd like to say publicly what I said to Mr. Sorensen on Friday, that I had great respect for his ability and his intelligence, that at no time did I feel that he had deliberately or with any intent taken classified material that would harm this country. I told him that personally. I say it publicly. I also told him in that particular meeting that in the research that we'd gone into in great detail, that he was an extremely moral man, finding in personal notes and so on that he had written when he was in the White House, even turning down the offer of a couple of theater tickets because he did not feel that it was proper in his position to accept a couple of $7 or $8 theater tickets. Well, Mr. Sorensen, I wanted to say that to you publicly, not just privately. You know I had some concerns about the nomination, not to your honesty or your integrity or your ability, but I used the phrase I felt the wrong man for the wrong position, and that Secretary of HUD, you, or someplace else, that you would be an extreme asset to the new President of the United States. I know this has been a difficult decision for you. I personally have appreciated the opportunity of getting to know you this week, and I wish you well in the future.
So, bye. Chairman, I think it should also be pointed out that, at least in the preliminary memorandum done by my staff and members of the staff, that the questions which I was going to raise about the espionage law as whether or not they're violated, the conclusion of the staff was there was no violation. There, in fact, is no evidence that any law has ever been violated by Mr. Sorensen, and I'm sorry that it's not going to be made part of the record in terms of being able to flesh out this entire area so that it would aid us further in formulating a revision of those unclear laws. But I should say that it is emphatically clear in my opinion, and I think in the tentative opinion of the staff memorandum, that there was no violation of any law. And I would also like to point out that, Ted, you're one of the classiest men I've ever run across in my whole life.
Chairman, much is said in these halls about presumptions attaching to nominations by the President of the United States. And it seems to me, in light of what's happened here today, that if we're serious about honoring those nominations and those recommendations, it would be well for committees of the Congress, and particularly of the Senate, which have the obligation of confirmation, to honor that presumption and at least let a hearing go forward before all members or a majority of the members of those committees make up their mind as to how they intend to vote. Otherwise, it seems to me to make mockery of the hearing and confirmation process. I, for one, am extremely saddened by what has occurred. I don't believe Mr. Sorensen has received his day in court, and I'm afraid his case was prejudiced at the outset.
Senator Hatfield?
Chairman, Mr. Sorensen, I think you know that I've been a longtime admirer of yours, and I applaud your statement here today. Not that I had to hear your statement today to be fully convinced of the rather exaggerated claims made under the charges, but I do feel that your statement today again affirms in my mind and should affirm in the total public's mind the integrity of your personal character, of your marvelous public record, even before it was necessary to do so publicly. I want to applaud you and salute you and say that in no way has this incident ever diminished, in my opinion, my high regard for you personally.
Morgan? Sorensen, I say to you that you've made a very excellent presentation this morning, and Senator Monahan has made one on your behalf. On the two occasions on which you and I talked, I think you will recall that I expressed to you my reservations about your appointment to this particular job, but also the esteem in which I held you and the work that you've done in the past. I must say to you that as I flew to Raleigh last night with the briefing book and read in that briefing book the proposed statements to be made before this committee by at least two organizations, if not more, I found myself somewhat in a dilemma, because many of the remarks in those statements were so intemperate that I hesitated to even be associated with any sort of opposition whatsoever. I hope you understand that my reservations about your particular appointment to this job was not for the purpose to suppressing a different point of view, but were reservations founded on what I believe to be real reasons.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sorensen, in the stressed turn of events, it's rather obvious that some of these political, personal references to you were the ultimate in political poppycock efforts to desecrate your character. I think anybody who'd studied the case knew there wasn't a question of laws being violated, of a man high public trust intentionally undertaking to do damage to the country. And you quite accurately pointed out, sir, never, the publishing of your books and speeches and articles, never has anyone laid a charge on you of damaging the security of this country. The concern that I had, very frankly, were concerns that came from your own mouth or pen. The disclosures in the affidavit, the recognition that one of the major responsibilities that you had was, as I recall you said this morning, the task of restoring public trust and confidence. Now, I was hopeful, frankly, I was confident that in the hearings, as we heard about past practices, that as we had a chance to read into the record, for all the world to know, as some of us have known, your personal sensitivity to these problems, that this matter would be laid to rest and that the problem of confidence restoring could be proceeded with. I must say, I think what you've done is a rather gutsy thing. But I was hoping that this committee could take advantage of your presence here. Now, perhaps, Mr. Chairman, it's inappropriate not only to move ahead with the restoring of confidence with you as the director of CIA, but to take advantage of this rather unique experience you've had of past classification, past practices, to advise us as we proceed with our mandate, not only oversight, but of drafting wiretap legislation, mail openings, repetitious entry, the charter that our subcommittee, this committee as a whole, has put together. I would hope, if this is not the appropriate time, that we could get your assurance to let us have the benefit. What information should be kept secret? You're in a unique position to tell us that. And one last thought, Mr. Chairman. I've already said more, I guess, than the time is appropriate. It's hard to separate one's personal feelings from one's responsibilities. But I have to confess to you that one of the reasons I was hoping we could put this matter to rest and proceed with you as director of CIA is that I am painfully aware, as I'm sure you are, and hopefully most of this committee is, that some of the people are out to get you, not because of what you said in that affidavit, but because they don't want a clean broom at CIA. And this committee is going to have a clean broom and a director that can bring objectivity into that important post.
Senator Hathaway?
Just 30 seconds, if I may, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to keep Mr. Sorensen here any longer. Knowing how you must feel after having made the statement you just made, I just want to say that I respect your decision, respect your judgment, and say that you were a big man when you entered this room, and you're going out an even bigger man. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, as one who developed some concern about this nomination, I too would like to say that never in my consideration of this designee was there any question in my mind about his loyalty, about his integrity, his dedication to this country, and his intelligence, or even in his ability to administer the job in which he was designated for. I voted against George Bush for that position as a member of the former committee on investigations of our intelligence. I felt that Mr. Bush did not have the sufficient background to fill that job. I was wrong on that vote. I think George Bush did become a very effective and competent administrator of our central intelligence. I'd just like to say that I have never been persuaded one ounce by those who I think had a personal axe to grind in relation to the nomination of Ted Sorensen. I came to this committee hearing with an open mind. I came seeking and hoping for reassurances. And I'm sorry that we don't have an opportunity to receive those reassurances. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. The chair has received requests from two senators who are not members of the committee to make brief remarks. I'm certain there'll be no objection. I'd like to recognize at this time Senator McGovern.
Mr. Chairman, I'm deeply distressed at what has happened here today. I was not aware that Mr. Sorensen was going to withdraw his name, but I have a brief statement which I'd like to give to the committee as I had prepared it, because as far as I'm concerned, nothing has changed about these judgments. I've known all of the directors of the agency during the past 20 years, and I'm convinced that Ted Sorensen is as well qualified, if not better, to head this agency than any of those predecessors. His experience, his judgment, his reliability, his intelligence are all stronger than we are accustomed to in this office. I've known him as a friend, as an associate, as a dedicated public servant, as a presidential confidant, and as an eminent attorney. He's a man of intense patriotism, who can be relied upon absolutely to put the national interest first and foremost at all times. It's because I know his qualities of mind and character so well that I deeply resent the scurrilous attacks that were unleashed against him this past weekend. I think they're a disgrace to decency and to justice. Certain, for the most part, unidentified people have leaked a variety of stories to the press designed to prejudice the nomination of this man, and I think that's the real reason this withdrawal took place this morning. The campaign waged against him has not been equal since the days of the late Joe McCarthy. Now, what is being said of Ted Sorensen? They say first that he doesn't have experience. The truth is that he has more experience in both national and international affairs than the president-elect who nominated him. The director of the CIA does not need to be an experienced spy or an experienced break-in artist. If on-the-job experience in such activities were needed in the director's office, we should be seeking out H.L. Hunt or James McCord or J. Gordon Liddy. But these experienced CIA men have all been sent off to jail, which is one way of reminding us that what the CIA now most needs is a director of sound moral character with a knowledge of American legal and constitutional principles and a clear sense of the national interest. Ted Sorensen has all of these qualities. Talk about experience. He was the White House counsel under the late President Kennedy. He was a trusted aide of John Kennedy during all of his years in the Senate. He traveled the length and breadth of this land during his long four-year bid for the presidency. And in the White House, he was the principal drafter of the great messages President Kennedy delivered to the nation and the world. But beyond this, he was a trusted advisor in every area of government, including many matters involving the intelligence functions. He saw it firsthand, the operation of the governmental process. And Mr. Chairman, I think few, if any, men ever to serve as director of the CIA brought to that office the wide-ranging experience of Mr. Sorensen. It is said that he took government papers, including classified papers, with him when he left the White House. But this is not something that he has concealed. The committee has these affidavits because they were volunteered by Mr. Sorensen at the time of the public trial of Daniel Ellsberg. He gave this affidavit as a means of demonstrating a fact of life, which is that it is customary for White House aides to take their files with them when they leave government service. It is said that he leaked classified information, but he has assured this committee, as he has others who've asked him about it, that he never released classified information except when ordered to do so by the President of the United States. Nor has anyone demonstrated how anything he ever released under presidential order damaged this nation in the slightest. If certain senators are so incensed about the practice of leaking, how do they explain their own conduct in anonymously leaking reports about Mr. Sorensen? And why don't they get more incensed about the persons who in recent days have leaked the classified CIA estimates of Soviet military strength relative to American military strength? What about the constant leaking by the Pentagon of classified information on weapons systems? One unnamed senator was quoted in yesterday's Post as follows. The job requires a man of authority, a man who can control the entire intelligence community, a Jim Schlesinger, not a Sorensen. The director of the largest intelligence service in the world is a leaker. It undermines the whole intelligence effort. It raises questions about his judgment, end of quote. I submit, Mr. Chairman, that a statement like that raises questions not about Mr. Sorensen's judgment, but about the judgment of the anonymous senator. That senator appears to be more accomplished at leaking than at judging. If he regards leaking as the most serious offense of the CIA, what does he think about the agency's record of attempted but bungled assassination efforts, its working alliance with the criminal underworld, its crude efforts to subvert independent governments, its secret wars, its shabby un-American performance for so many years in so many places? It is these shameful self-defeating practices that jeopardize the CIA and that must be brought under control if that agency is not to continue discrediting the good name of the United States. Finally, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sorensen is the kind of man who would know what his agency is supposed to do well and what it was not supposed to do. And I sincerely had hoped, for the sake of this country, that he would be confirmed in the important assignment for which President-elect Carter has selected him. On the basis of what I know about this nomination, and on the basis of what I've heard said about it in the press this past weekend, I can only conclude that if it is being rejected, we can mark it down that the ghost of Joe McCarthy still stalks the land. And Mr. Chairman, I can't tell you how deeply distressed I am personally, and as one who loves this country, at the shameful experience we've come through this past weekend. I think it's a dreadful beginning for a new administration to be dealt a blow of this kind. I deeply resent it. I'm deeply concerned for what it forebodes for this country.
Thank you very much. I believe I owe it to the committee and to the members of the staff to address myself to the suggestion that we have leaked information to the press. I can say without reservation that the members of this committee, the members of the staff, have not leaked any information to the press. The documents in question, the two affidavits, were not classified material to begin with. They were matters of public record. As one member of the committee, I can assure you that no member of the press ever got to me. I would like to express my apologies now for not answering your telephone. It was a miserable day this weekend, this yesterday and the day before. But I don't wish the record to show, without any response, that we have been responsible for leaks. As chairman of this committee, I'm proud to serve in this capacity. And I can say that this committee has done its best during its 8 months. And I'm certain the members of the press will concur with us that this is one committee where the leaks are almost non-existent. And I hope that we continue in this fashion. Senator Metzenbaum.
I came to this committee today because I had sort of felt building up the kind of pressure against the confirmation of Mr. Sorensen. And because I've known Mr. Sorensen over a period of many years, because I was predisposed to support his nomination, I said I had to hear for myself what the evidence was, that I could not really believe Mr. Sorensen, with his distinguished record of public service over a period of many years, could really have been, quote, guilty of some of the scurrilous things that have been said about him in recent weeks. I think it's a sad day when a man is nominated, as has been Mr. Sorensen, and that before the evidence is in, before any evidence is heard, that his reputation, his personal reputation, is put in the kind of aura that has occurred with respect to Mr. Sorensen. I think Mr. Sorensen withdrawing his nomination bothers me much. It bothers me for him, but it bothers me more for the country. Because it means to me that other men who don't fit the necessary mold of those who think they know who should be the head of the CIA or who should hold a particular position in government will be able to build up a climate of public opinion making it necessary for the nominee to withdraw his name. I think the individual loses, but I think the country suffers far more. Not alone with respect to the one individual who withdraws his name, and I empathize with Ted Sorensen in that respect, but with all of those other individuals who are unwilling to submit their names because they too may have suffer the same kind of castigation without justification, without cause. I think the country has suffered a great loss today, and I'm sorry, Mr. Sorensen, saw fit to withdraw his name from consideration of this committee in the United States Senate.
Senator Baker?
Chairman, I thank you very much. I would express the same surprise that the chairman did when he indicated that he had not expected Mr. Sorensen to withdraw his nomination. In a way, I'm sorry. I'm genuinely sorry that we did not know of that situation ahead of time. It might have been possible to handle this situation in a different way, with greater sensibilities, greater respect for the sensibilities. But that was not the case. I think Mr. Sorensen has done a brave and generous thing today. I think it was brave in that it required a degree of personal determination, careful searching of his own situation, his own viewpoints and ideas in this respect, a generous thing that it has, I believe, avoided a conflict which was sure to ensue, which would have created an unfavorable and probably an unpleasant, certainly an unpropitious beginning for a new administration during inaugural week. So I think that what Mr. Sorensen did today was not only electrifying, but it was brave and generous. I commend him for it. I would only add this, Mr. Chairman, if I may. I underscore what you said previously. I know of no leak of any information, certainly no significant information, from this committee, either members or staff. I don't say that by way of defense, but rather because I think that the integrity of this committee and its reputation for being able to keep a secret those things with which it is dealing is imperative if the committee is to function as an effective oversight committee. So I thoroughly agree with you. I know of no such leaks. I personally would represent to you, Mr. Chairman, which I believe needs no representation, that as far as I'm concerned, there have been no leaks of any information, classified or otherwise, that has come into the possession of this committee. I suppose the final thing I should say is that it's in the nature of the American congressional and political system that there should be a nomination and a testing. That is clearly so, regardless of the power that's in the White House, the party that's in the White House. It's often misunderstood by foreign observers, our friends in the foreign press in particular, but it's well understood in the United States intuitively and instinctively by our citizenry and certainly by our press that while politics may not be an adversary proceeding, at least it is a system of testing. And Congress is the only place to test. There is no minority president. There is only a minority in the Congress. And I think that the best interests of the minority, the best interests of the country, and indeed the best interests of the administration are best served by frank and open and candid appraisal of the situation as it occurs. I personally am sorry, Mr. Sorensen, for this situation and for the distress I'm sure it has caused you. But I am personally certain that you and others understand the necessity for the testing. I commend you again. I reiterate, it was a brave and generous thing you did today. And I think it will augur to your credit and your future reputation. Thank you.
Mr. Sorensen, in behalf of the committee, I thank you for your presence here this morning. And I wish you well, sir. The hearing is adjourned.
Good afternoon. I'm Lynn Scherr. I'm here in the Senate caucus room where the Senate Intelligence Committee hearing Ted Sorensen testify for the purpose of his confirmation as director of the Central Intelligence Agency has just been startled a little over an hour after the proceedings began. As you may have heard and seen right here, Ted Sorensen announced that he had asked President-elect Carter to withdraw his name in nomination for director of the Central Intelligence Agency. This, incidentally, after reading his entire opening statement, he really stuck to his script. He went through a point-by-point summary of a refutation of all the charges that had been brought against him. But nonetheless, when it was all over, he departed from his script, and then he read a statement in which he announced that he was going to ask Governor Carter, quote, to withdraw my designation as Director of Central Intelligence. He also said, my regret stems not from my failure to get this post, but from my concern for the future of our country. Incidentally, Mr. Sorensen went on to say that if he were to continue to fight for the post, which he said would be his natural inclination, it would only handicap the new administration if he was rejected, or handicap his effectiveness as director if he were confirmed. He went on to say that he returns to private life, quote, with a clear conscience. He says, I have never compromised my conscience, and I'm unwilling to do so now in order to ensure my nomination. Well, the first thing that happened after Mr. Sorensen's announcement of his withdrawal was that Senator Inouye, the chairman of this committee, said this was not expected. That was probably the least strong thing he could say in view of that. Everybody on the committee was startled, everybody in the audience. Senator McGovern, who was set to testify on behalf of Mr. Sorensen, waited until the committee called on him, and he came and delivered his speech nonetheless on behalf of Mr. Sorensen, saying he was deeply distressed that Mr. Sorensen had in fact submitted his withdrawal. Some of the other comments we got from the senators on the committee, they all felt they had to jump in and say something after this very, very surprising turn of events. Senator Baugh said he was distressed, and he called it a gutsy thing on Mr. Sorensen's part. Senator Hathaway said, you were a big man when you entered this room, and you're a bigger man as you go out of it. As I say, Senator McGovern, who was all set to make a speech in favor of Mr. Sorensen, stood up and said that he was deeply distressed. He said he felt that the ghost of Joe McCarthy still stalks this room, if in fact some of the charges brought against him were going to be there. Ted Sorensen, we have just learned, is going to have a press conference right here in the Senate caucus room in just a moment. We'll try to get our cameras set over there and ready to begin. We'll let you know as soon as that's going to happen. Incidentally, in the room is also Jack Watson from the Carter Transition Team. We're going to try to speak with him and get his reaction to it. A number of senators, all the members of the committee are still here. I believe that Sorensen is ready to start his press conference now.
Okay. Mr. Sorensen, could we ask you at what point this morning you decide to draw your resignation?
This is a decision that has been evolving over the weekend.
Right while you sat here today, or had you told me to draw prior to your resignation this morning?
No, I knew prior to my answer.
When did
he fired? At approximately 2 minutes to ten this morning.
They can't hear because they're coming in.
Now we have an audio problem here. Yes, I spoke to Governor Carter on the telephone in the booth downstairs as I entered the building. He regretted very much my withdrawal. Well, he and I had been talking over the weekend, and he was aware of the situation.
What made you wait till this morning?
Because I wanted to answer the personal charges that had been made against me before I withdrew.
Mr. Sorensen, is there any chance that you might reconsider the nomination?
No.
Why do you claim that enforcement of the public?
Because it has become apparent to me that some individuals in the intelligence community prefer someone of a different philosophy and with different experience.
Were you convinced, Mr. Sorensen, that this committee would not pass on your nomination? Were you convinced that you would not be confirmed by this committee?
No, I was not convinced. But as I said in my statement, I was convinced that if I were to be confirmed, it would be with a substantial division that would handicap my effectiveness in the job.
What do you mean, Mr. Sorensen, you say a different philosophy?
Well, I tried to spell out in my statement what I regard as legitimate arguments that can be made against me. Arguments with respect to my experience and arguments with respect to my views. I happen to think they are fully compatible with the job of Director of Central Intelligence, but I know that there are those who disagree.
How did you become aware that some people in the past believed that you did not want to accept some of your views?
Well, it's one senses that sort of thing.
Do you want to talk to your director, though, or not?
No. Well, I'll say once again that I said in my statement if I had been confirmed, it would have been with a divisive and narrow margin that might well have handicapped my effectiveness in the job.
Sure, Senator McGovern.
Pardon? Well, I obviously, until the vote was counted, did not know. So all I knew was that the opposition was substantial.
As a result of this experience, do you see that the community is being very heavily influenced by people that hold
I would not want to characterize the intelligence community as a whole. The people with whom I have been working at the agency have been extremely supportive of both my views and my qualifications.
Mr. Sorensen, did I understand you correctly? You said the president-elect did not try to persuade you to see the thing through.
Well, as of this morning, he did not, but as I say, he and I have had several conversations over the last few days, and he has stoutly insisted that I stay in the race as the weekend began.
But as of this morning, he did not.
As of this morning, he did not.
How much do you think politics played in this?
I would assume that politics had something to do with the charges that were being circulated against me.
Do you share Senator McGovern's view that this means that the ghost of Joe McCarthy stalks this room and this place?
Well, I think I would prefer to let Senator McGovern speak for himself on that.
Mr. Sorensen, can you say why you did it in this dramatic fashion, why you saved your withdrawal to the end rather than announcing it at the beginning and then answering your question? Why did you do that?
Possibly because none of you would have been listening when I answered the charges against me. Not at this time.
Who did circulate the charges against you? Any idea? What kind of people or what people specifically?
Well, I think some of that has already appeared in the press. You can also take a look at the organizations, the American Conservative Union, the Liberty Lobby, spokesman for the John Birch Society, and others who have asked to testify against me. You might also talk to those reporters who have talked to senators who have been putting out this information.
If Senator McGovern mentioned senators, what senators said?
Well, I would assume the press knows that, since they always refuse to be quoted. My name. No. No, I was asked who was circulating charges, and I listed some of those who are circulating charges.
You believe there were senators circulating some of those allegations?
According to the press, and I believe a little bit of what I read in the newspapers.
Did the governor in any way explain, Mr. Sorensen, why he so strongly supported you yesterday afternoon and urged you and insisted that you stay in the race the day before yesterday, and yet this morning put up no particular opposition to your withdrawing? Did he explain what had changed his mind, or what?
The governor and I jointly reached the conclusion stated in my final paragraph that there is substantial opposition in the Senate, which would result either in my rejection, which would handicap his administration if it gets off to a new start, or result in my being confirmed by a narrow vote, which would handicap my effectiveness as I got off to a start as Director of Central Intelligence.
I understand that, sir, but wasn't that known to you Sunday afternoon or Saturday morning?
Well, I would say there's been a good deal of assessment of the vote taking place throughout the weekend. That decision has also been evolving. Like lots of decisions, it's difficult to pinpoint a specific moment, but it was obviously not conclusive until 2 minutes of 10 when I telephoned Governor Carter.
But your type statement had to be done beforehand.
Yes, although that particular page was not a part of the mimeograph statement.
When was that prepared?
That was prepared late last night.
You were prepared to go either way last night, is that it?
Well, I knew pretty well last night which way I was going.
If you withdrew your nomination because the opposition is elements of the intelligence community...
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that.
You know that if you did, for that reason, does that mean that the next appointee will share their views and consult with you?
No. I think that, first of all, let me say that I have not condemned and will not condemn the intelligence community as a whole. That's a grave mistake. I met out there some of the brightest and ablest and most dedicated people I have ever met anywhere in government. I worked extremely well with them. I found them very much compatible with my views and attitudes on covert operations, on the role of intelligence in American society, on the kind of role America should play in world affairs. As in any large organization, there are undoubtedly individuals who take a different point of view. Some of those individuals have friends in Congress, in the press, and elsewhere. And I have been led to believe that some of those individuals, I would not even know their names, have been a part of the campaign against me. The next director of Central Intelligence hopefully will not be as vulnerable to the kind of personal malicious attack which enabled those who oppose me on for policy reasons to hide behind these personal attacks in order to achieve their purpose.
Mr. Sorensen, do you feel that any one of the senators who you perceive was opposed to your nomination was an admirer?
I think one would simply have to check the congressional record to find out what some individuals in this committee said about Joe McCarthy.
Aside from that, do you think anybody...
That's not a
very serious question here, saying that Joe McCarthy, the ghost of Joe McCarthy, stalks the land, as I recall. Now, do you agree with that? Because I noticed you didn't want to second that.
I believe it's more appropriate for me to talk about my statement and Senator McGovern to talk about his statement.
Mr. Sorensen, on our discussion initially with President Carter McCain, when you agreed to take this job, was there any inkling that this would be such a controversial nomination that you would have to fight in order to become the director of the LLC?
No.
None at all.
Again, if you would read the statement which I have delivered, you would find that I submitted an affidavit at the request of counsel with respect to the inconsistencies and anomalies with respect to classification practices in Washington at the time I served. That was my sole function in the Ellsberg trial, as it had been in the New York Times trial, which preceded it. What I said was, in much more general statement, that I thought the public was entitled to know the tragic history of the Vietnam War.
Mr. Sorensen, in any way, you condemn Elton in any way?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Mr. Sorensen, do you condemn Elton in any way for the way to release those statements?
I really regard either approval or condemnation of Daniel Ellsberg in 1977 as an irrelevant question. He is not on trial here today.
Mr. Sorensen.
Would you be conferring with the president-elect on your successor? Will he ask your opinion? Have he asked your opinion?
Well, he did not have time to ask it this morning. If he should ask, I would be glad to give him my opinion.
Mr. Sorensen, would the president-elect and or his staff know, prior to your being chosen for the CIA job, about your Ellsberg affidavit and New York Times affidavit and the other charges which you allude to in your own statement?
Well, I haven't the slightest idea how thorough their investigation of my background was prior to the time the president-elect asked me to take on this assignment.
I mean, did you provide them with this information yourself?
No, but this is all on the public record. As far as I know, no person who is being considered for a post has asked himself to provide the information.
You are not asked to provide any information yourself?
No.
You spoke of finding compatible views out of the CIA. You also spoke of opposition in the intelligence community. Just suppose you move the information that comes on the intelligence community more opposed to you than the CIA part?
No.
So, Mr. Lawson, do you think that the events of the this last weekend and today would tend to support the proposition by some senators that the intelligence agency and the Central Intelligence Agency are just a rogue elephant out of control in the way they gutted this nomination?
No, definitely not.
So Mr. Sorensen, could you give us some estimate of how much time you spent talking with Governor Carter before he nominated you?
Well, I've known Governor Carter for a year and a half.
Right.
If you're talking about the specific discussion relating to this selection, that can...
How many hours?
You can ask me, some of your colleagues who were in Plains on that Saturday afternoon can judge from the time I arrived and the time I left. It was a few hours.
Few hours. Now, during those few hours of discussion with Governor Carter, are you at liberty to tell us whether he or you ever discussed this controversial affidavit?
What's a controversial affidavit?
The Ellsberg.
I did not regard it as a controversial affidavit.
Okay, then the affidavit. Did you discuss
it? For that reason, I didn't discuss it.
And he didn't either?
No.
Thank you.
Mr. Sorensen, do you agree with
folks,
Senator...
Folks, I think we ought to make this the last question.
Do you agree with Senator Baker's analysis that the designated head of the CIA should be above controversy? Above reproach.
He certainly should be above reproach. But to say that he should be above controversy invites a repetition of what happened here, whereby those who are opposed to an individual for his views will start circulating totally unfounded charges against him. And then they will say, this man is controversial and therefore must be rejected.
Thank you all very much.
Given this experience and your willingness, though, to go on and speak to Mr. Carter about his successor, Mr. Sorensen, what would you recommend?
Well, I think it's clear from the statements delivered by the mourners after the deceased had been laid down that in their consideration of the next director of Central Intelligence, they could do worse, and they probably will.
Well, you've just heard the press conference delivered by Ted Sorensen following his very surprising withdrawal of his name from nomination as director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Some of the things that we learned from Mr. Sorensen's press conference were that he did not tell Governor Carter of his decision until 2 minutes before 10, just as he entered this office building. He telephoned him and told him that. It was apparently a very brief conversation. Mr. Sorensen said he would not reconsider his decision. He is definitely not a man whose name can be now placed in nomination again for CIA director. He would not say whom he thought were the sources of what he earlier called scurrilous and unfounded personal attacks on what he talked about as his personal side, as opposed to his professional side. He said that was really up to the press, the reporters who had gotten those leaks, the reporters who had spoken to those senators. Mr. Sorensen was asked if he would have any role in helping choose a successor. He said Mr. Carter had not yet asked him that, but he would be glad to. Well, that about wraps it up for this very surprising hearings here at the Senate Caucus Room. I'm Lynn Scherr. Good afternoon.
And so, on an unexpected and dramatic note, the Senate Intelligence Committee ended its hearings today on the nomination of Theodore Sorensen to be director of the CIA. At the outset, during his opening statement, Sorensen announced that he was withdrawing his name from consideration because of strong opposition in the Senate. The announcement came as a bombshell, since Sorensen had indicated prior to the hearing that he would fight for the CIA job. It had turned out to be a most controversial nomination, but President-elect Carter had defended the choice, calling the attacks against Sorensen's nomination unfair, and said the attacks against his judgment and loyalty were groundless. But several Democratic senators on the committee talked with Mr. Carter over the weekend, and they talked to him about withdrawing Sorensen's name from consideration. They advised the president-elect that it would be difficult to win Senate confirmation. Senate Democratic leader Byrd had expressed reservations, and Senate Republican leader Baker had said he would oppose the nomination. The criticism was based on a number of allegations that Sorensen used secret government material in writing a book after he left the White House staff in 1964, that he was a conscientious objector during the Korean War, that he was inexperienced in foreign affairs, that he may have played some role in the assassination plots against foreign leaders during the Kennedy years. Sorensen gave an impassioned defense against these charges and concerns, denying everything in his formal testimony, saying he would not be intimidated by attacks on his integrity and his competence, declaring, quote, "I prize my country and my honor too greatly to desert this post under a cloud." Then, surprisingly, he announced that he was stepping aside, noting substantial opposition to his nomination. Afterward, in talking to reporters, as you heard just a few minutes ago, Sorensen said that he had decided last night to withdraw his name, but he didn't inform Mr. Carter until just before the hearing began this morning. He called him from a phone booth in the Senate office building. He said Mr. Carter told him that he regretted his decision, but he did not try to stop Sorensen from going ahead. I'd like to turn now to two intelligence experts who have been sitting here watching this morning's dramatic proceedings with us. Ray Klein, former deputy director of the CIA and author of a recent book, Secret Spies and Scholars, and David Wise, author of another recent book, The American Police State. No one anticipated what happened this morning, most of all the three of us who were sitting here watching it. Do you feel that Sorensen did this because he recognized that he couldn't be confirmed?
I think that's definitely the case, and I think he was very wise. The intensity of the criticism and the variety of sources from which it came mounted all through the weekend, and regardless of what you think originally of the Sorensen's qualifications for the job, he was in a no-win situation. As he said, if he had been nominated, if he'd been confirmed, he would have been a crippled leader of the intelligence community with bad relations with a substantial part of this very important Senate committee. It's a sad thing that the nomination was made and then withdrawn, and it leaves the whole problem in an unfortunate state. But I think Sorensen had very little choice except to do what he did.
It seems to me, Paul, that the key factor here is that this is Jimmy Carter's week. He's to be inaugurated on Thursday. This would be an unseemly ruckus to be running right into the time of rhetoric and festivities and parades. And it's obvious that Carter felt that he could no longer support Ted Sorensen. As Sorensen said in the press conference, he was not urged by the president-elect to continue his fight. And they must have felt they simply didn't have the votes, and they didn't want to put that to a test this week.
This did represent a switch for Mr. Carter, because he had indicated over the weekend in statements that he would stand by the nomination. But the presumption we have to make is that, as you suggest, they had read the handwriting on the Senate wall and recognized that the nomination was not going to get through.
You always stand by a nomination until you are convinced that it's going to fail. Obviously, as long as there's a chance, you keep trying. But I think Ted Sorensen and probably the president-elect, too, changed their minds sometimes in the last 48 hours.
I was just going to say that I think what's really interesting here is that what ended Sorensen's chances were the stories over the weekend that he had taken documents from the White House, used them for his book, and received a tax break. But that wasn't the real issue. The real issue was political or ideological, that Sorensen was too liberal for that job in the view of his critics.
You agree with that, Ray?
Well, not entirely. I think that the opposition came from many different areas, and different groups of people finally coincided in opposing the appointment. Originally, the objections were on the ground of lack of experience in foreign affairs, which is a legitimate criticism, and lack of experience at the managerial level in government as distinct from the staff advisory role he played in the White House. But these might well have been overcome had not these more sensational and personal attacks, which he tried to answer this morning, mounted on top of the others, raising doubts in the minds of at least a substantial part of the committee. This was his handicap, and I think he and probably President-elect Carter decided it was too great a handicap to try to overcome by bullying their way through with the nomination.
Didn't these doubts relate to the kind of policies that he might pursue as CIA chief?
That's the point I'm trying to make. I think basically it was felt this was coming from the conservative wing of the Republican Party, basically, and the Democratic conservatives as well. And I think that the tragedy here in terms of confidence in a government agency is that Sorensen represented the kind of person in this sense, an outsider. You don't want a professional spy to run the agency because the problem for CIA now is that no one has public confidence in CIA. So an outsider might have had a chance to restore that confidence. And I think that very possibly someone like Sorensen would be the best thing for CIA.
You mentioned the political factors, Dave. It struck me as being a bit unusual that the new Senate Republican leader, Howard Baker, had stepped forward so vigorously in saying that he regarded the nomination as unwise and that the committee should not confirm Sorensen, even before Sorensen himself had come before the committee to give his explanation.
Yes, and I think that probably focuses on the fact that this fight over the Sorensen nomination has a much larger context and a much larger meaning, because it's the first showdown between Carter and the Congress and the Republicans. It's almost as though the honeymoon is over before the marriage has taken place.
You both sound very naive to me, arguing solemnly about whether there's a political aspect to presidential appointments. Of course there's a political aspect to everything that happens in Washington, and of course this is partly a political decision, and there are substantial parts of the Congress and other parts of the country which oppose a rather liberal New York Kennedy wing, part of the Democratic Party. But I don't think those would have carried the day if there had not been some other rather thoughtful criticisms about his qualifications to do the job and then his personal suitability to do the job in the light of his attitudes toward Ellsberg and the Ellsberg papers. These all seem to me to be different and natural problems to come up, and it's putting them all together with the natural political environment of Washington that made it a bill of goods you just couldn't sell today. It would have been a 50-50 vote at best, and he was wise not to try to take office in those circumstances, I think.
As an old intelligence operator, Ray, do you think there might have been a covert operation run against Ted Sorensen?
Well, I was expecting you to say that.
I've asked him.
The man who started the whole theory of invisible government couldn't possibly fail to have a conspiracy in mind. I don't think so. I think there were many people in the intelligence agencies who disapproved of the choice of Sorensen for a variety of reasons. But as far as I could tell, they were all being, as he said, rather, instead of the ones he was in contact with, rather loyal and supportive. I talked to Sorensen only a couple of days ago, and he did not seem to be disturbed about the support he was getting from the agency. He thanked me for not criticizing his appointment, and I think he had a fair chance until these series of allegations over the weekend mounted up and caused him to feel it wasn't worth the battle, that he, as I say, would be a crippled leader even if he got the nomination.
But it was certainly true that the intelligence community was, at the very least, not enthusiastic about the Sorensen nomination.
Well, I think that's fair to say, and I can say what I actually told Ted Sorensen, that what the intelligence community wanted desperately was not someone of any particular political coloration or views. What they wanted desperately is someone like George Bush came to appear, in their opinion, a man who was nonpartisan, who was not acting politically, despite a political background, who was supportive of the agency, who felt that intelligence and intelligence estimates and the whole work of information gathering and reporting to the White House was crucial and needed to be done well. Bush did that beautifully, and he had good relations with Congress, trying to persuade them that CIA was about constructive and serious business, and that all of the past accusations of criminality and misbehavior would be forgotten and something done positively. Now, that's what the agency wanted. It's what all the intelligence people want. I think it's what the country wants. And there were doubts that Sorensen was exactly the man to create that atmosphere.
But one result of what's happened today, of course, is that the controversy over CIA, which began with the revelations of their domestic spying, Operation Chaos, the opening of mail, bugging and break-ins, and so on, and continued during the Church Committee investigations and the Pike Committee investigations, that controversy, which in my opinion has so damaged, and I think Ray Klein would agree, has so damaged the reputation of CIA, is now bound to continue because this has given it fresh impetus. Now we have a continuing trouble and difficulty over the appointment of someone to head this agency. So they're not out of the woods.
Well, I think that's right, and that's why I said it's a sad day for the U.S. government and for the integrity of our intelligence analysis process. I was very distressed at the immediate line of comment and questioning which came up. Did somehow the intelligence community sabotage this appointment? I don't believe that for a minute.
So there was no covert operation, you say?
There were a few covert operations, despite the public fantasies about them. Everybody likes to think of CIA as a very skillful cloak and dagger outfit, but in fact they are mostly doing very normal, humdrum business like reading files and writing reports like all the rest of us. And I'm quite sure that, as individuals, some of the men and women in the community may have expressed reservations about Sorensen, and so did many in the press and other places. They were, as an institution, I'm sure, helping Ken Sorensen, as he said, prepare his position and be ready to answer the questions at his confirmation hearing. I know that was the case.
There's another aspect to this, too, which we have not touched upon, and that is Sorensen's personality. Did that figure in this at all, do you?
Well, Ted Sorensen, for all of his brilliance as a writer, and he is said to have written Kennedy's stirring inaugural address in 1960, and many of the other speeches that Kennedy gave, and of course, Ray Klein said that he perhaps lacked, and the critics have said on the Hill that he perhaps lacked some managerial experience, but he was in effect the chief of staff of the White House, and I certainly think he would have had as much managerial experience as George Bush running the Republican National Committee. But I think that in terms of personality, if it had been an issue, it would have been one more after he had been confirmed and was attempting to deal with the Congress. It never really got to be an issue today because the hearing was aborted and the whole thing never went anywhere. But if there was any question about his personal relations, I think it would have been more in terms of CIA's relationship with the Senate Intelligence Committee after he had been confirmed, not at this stage.
Where does all this leave us now? What kind of man is Jimmy Carter likely to turn to?
Heavens only knows, but I can tell you where he ought to turn. He ought to turn to someone with nonpartisan qualifications, ability to get along with Congress, ability to get the personal support of the President in the White House, ability to manage the high-level interagency bureaucratic policies of intelligence, which are very complicated and serious, a sophistication about foreign affairs and international strategic problems, and then some understanding and support of the technical side of intelligence activities. He does not need to be a technician in any sense of the word, but he has to understand what goes on in order to supply information and useful judgments about international affairs to the government of the United States. If you can find that sort of a guy who's not got these personal problems, which unfortunately Ted Sorensen had surfaced in recent days, that's the kind of man to elect. It should not be a political decision because CIA should not be a political football.
I feel that whoever is appointed, I can tell you what he should not be. In my opinion, he should not be a professional spy. He should not be someone who's built a reputation in the very areas that have come under so much criticism, covert operations and cloak and dagger work. I think an outsider is needed, an outsider of integrity.
Somebody who is not as well known or certainly not as political as a Sorensen.
Well, it's going to be a very difficult act to follow. I don't envy whoever is nominated because of what happened today,
almost,
certainly.
Almost anybody is crazy to accept the job after this episode. But what the agency really needs is, as I said when Sorensen's name came up, another John McCone, a man who has political integrity and stature and an understanding of the intelligence business.
Thank you both. Well, this ends our coverage of today's Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on the nomination of Theodore Sorensen to head the CIA, a nomination now dead after Sorensen's dramatic withdrawal of his name. We'll be back on most of these PBS stations tonight with a wrap-up of the hearing highlights. I'm Paul Duke in Washington.